funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Could Texas ever become a swing state or even a blue state? Our most recent Democratic governor, Ann Richards, was voted out of office in 1994, and Texas has reliably delivered votes for GOP presidential candidates since 1980. But as our population grows increasingly urban and ethnically diverse, some observers believe the days of Republican-dominated statewide elections could be numbered, and some Democratic political strategists are working to take advantage of those changing demographics. Joining us to discuss this from the studios of KUT in Austin is Robert Draper. He's a contributing editor to Texas Monthly and a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine. His article, The Life and Death and Life of the Party, appears in the August issue of Texas Monthly. Robert, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So many people are aware, of course, that Texas was once a place where for more than a century only a Democrat had any hope of winning a statewide election. But of course, it's worth noting that the Democratic Party was a very different entity before the passage of the Civil Rights Act.
I think that's right. For a very long time, as you were saying, Chris, there were basically two types of politicians in Texas, and they were conservative Democrats and liberal Democrats. But the conservatives predominated, and this being a more conservative state that allies itself to some degree with the libertarian West, but more or less is in lockstep with the old Confederacy in the South. Its values have been as such, and politicians for the most part have reflected that. That began to change. There had always been a liberal wing to the Democratic Party, but it began to change over time, let's say around the 1990s, that the Democrats in Texas became branded, at least to some degree, then it was perception rather than reality, but branded by the Republicans effectively as liberals, and thus fell out of lockstep and joined kind of the slide of the National Democratic Party writ large throughout the South. What we've seen then is, as you just described it, a situation where the state of Texas has not seen a Democrat win statewide since 1994.
And so as one-time Texas Democrats switched parties, as a number of them did in the latter half of the 20th century, there was quite literally nothing for them to lose politically.
That's right. Yeah, we began to see this in the 1980s when a young congressman named Phil Graham switched from the Democratic Party in 1983 to the Republican Party. Later, we saw another Texas politician named Rick Perry do the same. And so the party switching all began on that side. And in the meantime, the Democratic Party had a really difficult time fielding an attractive slate of candidates. That really goes all the way up to the present, where though we now have a new situation where there are some very intriguing possible candidates, none of them has stepped forward as of yet and said, I'm going to run as a Democrat statewide.
How did the election of George W. Bush to the White House further empower the GOP in Texas?
Well, it put a face on the Republican Party, an appealing face for Texans. There's been a great love for the Bush family here in Texas, no secret to that. When he became president, and then more to the point, after 9/11, when his popularity soared nationwide, Texans felt an immense pride in him, and I think felt very much wedded to the post 9/11 surge of patriotism, to which Democrats at least seem to be out of step. And Bush also, and I would contrast him now to the view of Texas Republicans today, very much courted Texas Hispanics. And later, when he ran for president, Hispanics writ large. He said to me, I remember in an interview I did with him in 1998, that the Republicans throughout the nation needed to understand the demographic trends, that particularly it was the case in Texas, but it would be so elsewhere, that Hispanics would become the predominant demographic group and Republicans had better learn how to appeal to them and not just simply talk in terms of you're not part of us and let's build walls around Mexico. In other words, Bush got it. And for a long time, or at least for a period of time, I should say, Republicans were viewed nationwide, but certainly in Texas, as a place where blue dog Democrats could go, or yellow dog Democrats, really all kinds of Democrats. He made it palatable because of his kind of compassionate conservative branding to be a Republican.
You know, the appeal of George W. Bush notwithstanding, it does seem that Republicans for years have been saying if Latinos would only look at the values of the Republican Party, they would see that we have so much in common. There are family values. There, is a sort of self-sufficiency prized. And yet that appeal has never carried through to the entire party for the vast majority of Latino voters in this country.
That's right. And, you know, I'm speaking now as a national political reporter, in addition to being one who has written recently about Texas politics, that throughout New Mexico, Colorado, and elsewhere, Obama carried Hispanics by wide margins because despite, as you've just said, the view held by many Republicans that Latinos are very much in ideological lockstep, that they are, as Republicans have said to me over and over again, hardworking, believe in family values. That despite that Latinos throughout the United States viewed Republicans as hostile towards them. And here we're largely speaking of their views toward immigration. They're talking about self-deportation, as Mitt Romney did in 2012. And of course, the Republicans in Texas have been very, very much like that. I don't think Rick Perry has so much, but other Republicans have. And the perception here, though in Texas there are more rural Hispanics than there are, say, in California, the perception here still is that Republicans are hostile to Latinos. My source for that actually is the chairman of the state Republican Party, Steve Munisteri, who did polling on the subject himself and said that that's what their polls indicated.
So we will speak very specifically about some of the intriguing Democratic candidates that you alluded to earlier who have not yet stepped up. I have to wonder if some of the reluctance is not related to the fact that certainly statewide Democratic candidates have taken a beating in recent decades. And there's also the issue that even when there was Democratic money flowing to the party from Texas, it often didn't flow to Texas candidates.
No, in fact, one of the biggest Democratic donors, probably the biggest, the East Texas trial attorney now lives in Houston, Steve Mostyn, described Democratic donors as basically from Texas as an ATM machine for the National Party. And part of that's due to the fact that after a while, Democratic donors here in Texas got tired of giving money to people who were going to lose all the time. They wanted to have influence in Washington, these donors did. They wanted to be able to go to a party and be able to actually talk to a senator. And if that senator was typically a Republican senator in Texas, that did them no good. So they'd start donating to, say, Feinstein and Boxer, the two senators from California, and would in that way make their try to be heard, on Capitol Hill. So there's that situation, and it has been the case that the Democratic Party has it's probably axiomatic that that there are more wealthy Republicans in the state of Texas than there are wealthy Democrats. But there's still plenty of Democratic money here. It's just that they've been reluctant to spend it on candidates who they think are going to lose. And that, of course, becomes then a vicious cycle that a good candidate, a potentially good candidate, won't run because they don't see any money out there.
Hmm. All right. So let's talk about what makes Texas so potentially appealing to Democrats on a nationwide level. First and foremost, of course, would be that we voters in the state control 38 electoral votes, second only to California with 55. That makes this a really attractive target for political strategists nationally.
Sure. I mean, if the Democrats started with those two states in their column, California and Texas, then it's essentially over for the Republicans, unless some seismic demographic shift would take place in other big states. But given how successful the Democrats have been winning the popular vote in five of the last six presidential elections, but never winning it in Texas, if they could actually put Texas in the column, then it puts the Republicans in a world of hurt. That's what's made that prospect very appealing for the Obama field organization group known as Battleground Texas, headed by Jeremy Byrd, who was Obama's sort of field organizing wunderkind in 2008 and 2012 election cycles. They have, as of this January, come down and fielded a team of people whose goal it is to register more voters, to also get involved in candidate recruitment, certainly to get involved in persuading voters who are already registered to turn out at the polls and to bring more money here as a result. The hope being not only to help the state party, but to increase the prospects that a Hillary Clinton, for example, might be able to carry Texas in 2016. That seems unlikely to do it in 2016, and they're not suggesting that that's a plausible goal, but to make if at minimum they could make Texas competitive and force the National Republican Party to spend a lot of its money here, then that in and of itself would be a boon to the Democrats.
Yeah, it's telling that the organization is not called Blue Texas; it's called Battleground Texas. Like for now, that would be a significant, a sufficient achievement as far as the Democrats are concerned.
Absolutely. And you know, what they've said, they being Jeremy Byrd, who's the sort of the founder of Battleground Texas, and Jen Brown, who's the executive director here on the ground in Texas, what they've told me is that they've pointed out that, Texas is not really a one-party state. It's a non-voting state. It has very, very low-performing numbers among registered voters, not to mention millions of voters who are not registered but are eligible to do so. These are chiefly voters who one would imagine would be Democratic, that is to say Latinos and African Americans. They think as well that there are reachable voters, such as suburban women, who simply just don't know the facts about the Republican Party and how the Republican Party has been so effective at branding the Democrats while eluding being branded negatively by the Democrats themselves. And that's something the Battleground hopes to change.
I know that there are figures to demonstrate that there are in particular a lot of registered Latino voters who don't necessarily turn out at the polls. I have to wonder, though, on the Republican side, Robert, if there aren't a lot of Republicans who don't bother to vote because they have been until now fairly confident that their candidates would do all right whether they showed up or not.
That's precisely the argument that Republicans make, that that because these are not competitive contests, that that people don't bother to show up. I think, though, that while there's an element of truth to that, that argument actually cuts in both directions, that there are plenty of Democratic voters who don't see any point in going to all the trouble to vote when they know that they're just going to vote for a bunch of losers. And so that across the boards has been a phenomenon in Texas that both when it was a one-party state, that is to say a Democratic state, and now that it's a Republican state, that its numbers have always been low. Of course, this is a dangerous proposition for the Democrats who have believed, and we heard a lot of this in the 2002 cycle when the so-called Dream Team with Tony Sanchez at the top of the ticket was believed by Democrats to be the one that would lead them to the promised land. Embedded in that belief was that Sanchez would manage to get all of these previously non-voting or seldom voting Latinos to show up at the polls, and that simply did not happen. And so what the Democrats have to do is not only sort of try to get those voters to the polls and get sort of the persuadable voters to go to the polls, but to reach into all sorts of areas and cut into, for example, they're around Plano, Texas, which is heavily Republican and has crushed Democrats and will continue to do so for quite a while. But if they can perform better in places like that, even by, say, 4 or 5 percentage points, then these numbers add up. And this is, by the way, exactly what the Obama organization did in 2012, that they managed to cut into what had been dominant Republican areas in, say, Appalachia or something. So the theory of the case for Battleground Texas is if they do that across the boards, then that's going to help bring out a winning team.
Robert Draper is my guest. He's a contributing editor to Texas Monthly and a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine. He has an article in the August edition of Texas Monthly called The Life and Death and Life of the Party. You can join our conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in about 3 minutes.
funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Texas Monthly contributing editor Robert Draper, whose article in the August issue is called The Life and Death and Life of the Party. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Robert, for a number of reasons, it would seem that Battleground Texas has an uphill battle to fight. But one interesting thing about their strategy is that Byrd and Brown and their colleagues have determined that they don't necessarily need to blanket the entire state. They really can focus on a small number of counties where the population is really concentrated.
That's right. I mean, it's a fact that the Texas that lurks in our imagination and in the imagination of the nation, writ large, really doesn't exist anymore. I mean, it's that 59% of the state's general election voters are concentrated in, I think, just 13 of Texas's 254 counties. Now, those 13 counties are urban and suburban. So that's what Texas has become. It's much less of a rural state. And it means, therefore, that Battleground Texas can concentrate its efforts. And already Democrats have done so with a fair amount of success. After all, I've lived in Texas almost my entire life. Growing up, the notion that Dallas would be a Democratic stronghold, as the state began to tilt Republican, seemed preposterous. But Dallas is now a Democratic stronghold. Harris County, which has, I think, something like 15% of Texas's entire population, Obama carried in 2008 and then carried as well in 2012. And so what this means is that, if they can strategically pick certain areas, and the people of Battleground Texas had said very much that this is, like so many things in politics, a matter of, I hate this word, but here we go, narratives. And it's how they tell their story. They do not want, they don't want for the story to be or to be perceived that Battleground Texas is going to, carry the day in 2014, that suddenly Texas will turn blue in 2014, and if that doesn't happen, they're miserable failures. Instead, they want to tell their story as a story of increments, which makes it, frankly, a more boring story. But that's a story of registering more voters, developing more infrastructure, more volunteers, managing to pick up a few more county judges here and there. And it's sort of by those increments that you then set the stage for perhaps in 2018 or 2022 seeing Texas Democrats win in a fairly resounding way. But they know that incrementalism is the only way they can go.
Slow and steady wins the race.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Now, I have to say they've been slow. I mean, it's, they were going to announce, I think, on July the 1st, how much money they had raised in the first 4 months or so. And they didn't announce it until about July the 8th or 9th or 10th. And when the figures came out, they were $1.1 million. But actually, $200,000 of that is a check from Steve Mostyn that had been pledged to them, I think, back in December or early January. So when you subtract the Mostyn check, which they had been assuming all along, then they just raised $900,000, and though I don't know this for sure, the fact that they delayed announcing it is probably because they were still raising money off of the backs of Wendy Davis's filibuster, which means that they have not that much on their own been turning the ATM machine back into Texas, and they've got their work cut out for them. In other words,
all right, let's talk about Wendy Davis. She became sort of an overnight celebrity in some corners of the country. She's a notorious celebrity. Others, she is one to be celebrated. But how likely does it appear at this point that she is going to run for governor?
Well, you're asking me to intuit something. I'm willing to do that with the caveat that this does not come with hard information. No one from her side has said this to me. She's going to run. I would bet a year's salary on it. And I believe this for a couple of reasons that are interrelated. One of them is that it just stretches credulity to imagine that she would go back after all of the celebrity that she has attained and run for Senate District 10, you know, a district, by the way, that's going to be competitive anyway. So she's going to have to work hard to get reelected at that. And you know, to now have been so celebrated as a result of her filibuster, having been to Washington, D.C. twice in the last few weeks to raise a bunch of money, it's hard for me to imagine that all this is just for a state Senate race. Secondly, and related to that, she's an enormously competitive person and has been all about risk. I mean, it was a great risk for this unwed, you know, teenage mother to basically, who was really, you know, completely down on her luck, to go to TCU and to graduate with honors, and then after that to go to Harvard Law School in her early 20s, and then from there to go to the Fort Worth City Council, and then to run in a state Senate district that had been reliably red district, and go up against a seemingly undefeatable Republican incumbent, Kim Brimer, and to beat him. And then to turn around in 2012, after all these redistricting efforts by the Republicans to make her district even redder than before, to again beat a Republican challenger and to outperform Obama in that district in both years. So this is sort of what she's about. And it's hard for me to imagine, you know, given all of that, that she would go back to being state senator.
So, Robert, she has focused on a number of issues throughout her political career. Is it at this point an asset or a liability that, for those who did not know her before the filibuster stunt, she will forever and always be associated first with her pro-choice stand?
Well, certainly in Texas, it's more of a liability than an asset, at least in the very direct sense that this is how Republicans will tar her, you know, with being as Eric Erickson of RedState.com, a conservative blogger, put it, the abortion Barbie, that this is how she's going to be viewed. On the other hand, you know, what made that moment so powerful, Chris, I think, was not here's Wendy Davis standing up for abortion rights. What made it powerful was here's this specter of this petite woman standing in a chamber full of white males who are doing everything they can to break her during this 11-hour, you know, stand with Wendy moment. And that she was able to do so was really this kind of remarkable physical feat and a remarkable, you know, moment of endurance that captured the imagination of people all over the world above and beyond the particular issue for which she was fighting. So if she can continue to sort of portray herself as kind of this steel magnolia, this you know, woman who sort of sparks the imagination, which is something that Democrats in this state have not had as a candidate in quite some time, arguably not since Ann Richards, then I do think that she has a chance. But yes, the abortion issue is going to dog her. It's going to be a challenge. It will, though, be something that she can raise money off of nationwide. And I've run into her in Washington, D.C., when she's been with people from Emily's List, and that's where the deep pockets are. And it's a liability in terms of how it brands her ideologically, but it's where the money is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Zach in Fort Worth. Hi, Zach.
Hello, Chris. I'd like to ask your guest a kind of a so what question. So since the end of the Civil War, since Reconstruction, there's been an agreement, sometimes tacit, sometimes explicit, between business interests and Texas state government, that they kind of work together, that the state government promotes the interests of business. And it's been with Democrats and Republicans. So I want to ask him, if the Democrats do win some state offices, what would that really mean for your average Texan struggling to get by?
That's a real good question, and it's also something that Wendy Davis is going to have to confront. I mean, I think that among the first things that should Davis run, she's going to have to explain to a skeptical Texas electorate, or rather an electorate that's wary of Democrats, and particularly one who seems to be progressive, is that how she differs from Barack Obama and how her policies will you know, help the lives of average Texans. Now, I'll say this about Davis, that, and you being from Fort Worth, Zach might know this, you know, as when she was city councilwoman in Fort Worth, she also was the head of the Economic Development Board of Fort Worth, and she's perceived as being very business friendly and has a lot of you know, sort of corporate allies in that area. Whether or not she's able to to cast herself that way effectively remains to be seen. But in terms of actual policies, you know, Davis has talked to me a lot about how she believes that the Republican Party hasn't been, though they've espoused themselves as the conservative party, that some of their values aren't conservative. That, for example, they have created and kept alive a lot of tax exemptions, a lot of loopholes for specific businesses as a means of trying to incentivize them to create jobs, when those loopholes and exemptions probably outstayed their usefulness and thus cost the Texas taxpayers billions of dollars, money that could have been spent on other more effective public-private partnerships, alluding to your remark regarding the interplay between historically between business and government in Texas, that's something that could be put to use and would be a better use of government monies than some of these exemptions that perhaps have, as I say, overstayed their welcome.
Robert, how important is Texas considered nationally in the ongoing effort to gut or even eliminate provisions of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, it's something that they talk about a lot. I mean, it's not as simple as the Democratic talking points make it appear. You know, the Democrats will often point to the fact that fewer people have health insurance in Texas than just about any other state in America. But as my colleague at Texas Monthly, Erica Greeter, has frequently pointed out, I think also in her book, Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, that the health outcomes in Texas are more at the middle of the pack than they are at the very bottom. And so while Texas doesn't have an enviable record vis-a-vis health care, it also doesn't have as miserable a one. But Texas has become, sort of an opt-out, a focus center for the Medicaid opt-out is something that's been very much talked about, and of course is being emulated by other states.
So two other rising stars in the Democratic Party in Texas are the twin brothers Julian and Joaquin Castro, mayor of San Antonio and congressman, respectively. You write that you came away impressed by their political intuition, but also with the sense that they appear to be in no hurry to ascend to higher levels within politics.
That's right. Well, and it may work for them, Chris. I mean, Julian and Joaquin Castro are, I think, 38 years old. They got plenty of time. In other words, there's also the possibility that, let's say, if Julian Castro, I know that the Obama administration had essentially said to Mayor Castro that if he were interested in a cabinet position, they'd love to have him in the cabinet. But you could imagine a scenario where Senator Ted Cruz would completely hold up that confirmation, and in the meantime, they'd be gathering all this inside. They'd be gathering all this stuff on the Castros because they are on Julian Castro because he'd have to turn over all this material, and so it would be like a losing proposition on a variety of fronts. But Castro also believes, the mayor does, that he has plenty that left to achieve. To burnish his record as a very successful, it would seem, mayor of a very big city. Joaquin Castro is a freshman congressman and is well thought of in the Democratic caucus on the Hill. But he's just barely, he barely knows his way around the Capitol. He's only been there about 8 months or so. And so time is on these guys' sides. On the other hand, the Democratic Party clearly is wanting for the attractive candidates that these guys would appear to be. And as GOP State Chairman Steve Munisteri pointed out to me, finally you can talk about battleground Texas and you can talk about the emerging demographics. But people are going to have someone to vote for. And unless the Democrats can actually, proffer a slate of candidates, not just one, but several, then the Democrats will forever be perceived as a losing party, a party, for that matter, that the potential candidates themselves must view as a losing party, else they would be running.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We're speaking with Robert Draper of Texas Monthly Magazine. Let's go next on the phone to Brett in Louisville. Hello, Brett.
Hey, Chris. My question is, I've actually lived in several states throughout the United States, and this is actually the only state that I've ever lived in where the governor didn't actually have to debate the Democratic candidate. And I was kind of shocked to see that in the last election, and I looked back, and it's happened more than once. And I'm wondering if you think that whoever's running next time, if they will actually get to be able to have a debate with the Republican candidate.
Well, bear in mind that 2014 is going to be a unique situation, unique for us at least, insofar as we have not seen a slot in which you know, both there's no incumbent running in quite some time. So yes, there's certain to be a debate if it's Greg Abbott versus Wendy Davis or whomever else. It is true that that Rick Perry has not debated, say, Chris Bell or something. He didn't see the need to do so. Knew that that only bad could come of it. That he was going to, you know, run away with victory, you know, absent some kind of, you know, an oops moment, you know, as he committed on the national stage. But I should point out that George W. Bush, when he was a wildly popular incumbent, did in fact debate against Gary Morrow. He didn't do very well, but he did debate. So it's so the situation that you described, it is actually unique to Governor Perry.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Mark in Dallas. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Chris. I had a question. Like in Canada, there is a conservative government in Canada, and there's a lot of legal immigration there. It's substantially higher than America, though it's much smaller population there. Why doesn't the Republican Party see more legal immigration as a positive for Republican Party? Because a lot of immigrants have conservative views, as you said. It's not just about the illegal immigration, it's also about the legal immigration. And that is totally messed up and a lot of problems.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Mark. Any thoughts from a Texas perspective, Robert?
Well, only that Texas Republicans, and for that matter, Republicans nationwide, have taken pains to say that, no, we welcome legal immigrants. In particular, they have been focusing on highly skilled legal immigrants. And so, you know, you see that as something that a lot of Republicans, both Republican presidential candidates and Republicans here in the state, have talked about. The difficulty is that that gets drowned out by, you know, the more extreme voices who talk about the 11 million who are already here, about the need to seal the border, about, you know, doing all they can to stiff arm the DREAM Act from becoming a reality. It's those kinds of remarks that I think, you know, resonate more in the Latino community. And for that matter, to be fair to the Republicans, the Democrats have been successful at demagoguing, at tarring the Republicans with. Certainly Obama did that with McCain, for example, in 2008, when McCain had been actually a very staunch supporter of comprehensive immigration reform to the degree that almost cost him his candidacy. So, you know, that's something that Democrats have done, and it's not always in step with what the reality on the ground is, but there have always been just enough Republicans to say something extreme and thereby to shoot themselves in the foot to aid and abet the Democrats' portrayal of them as such.
Robert Draper is my guest this hour. He's contributing editor to Texas Monthly, which features his story, The Life and Death and Life of the Party, in the August issue of the magazine. If you want to be part of the conversation, send email to think@kera.org or call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour from the studios, joining us from the studios of KUT in Austin with Robert Draper. He's a contributing editor to Texas Monthly, which features his article, The Life and Death and Life of the Party, in the August issue of the magazine. You can join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Robert, how seriously are Republican political strategists taking the efforts of Battleground Texas?
Well, that's an interesting question and a little bit difficult to respond to, if only because, it's clear on the one hand that they are using the presence of Battleground Texas as a fundraising tool. A number of folks have, certainly the state Democratic or Republican Party has, and indeed has been able to get a bunch of money from the Republican National Committee, the National Republican Party, as a result of this, basically saying, you know, that the battle is joined and we need reinforcements. It's not clear to me that they take Battleground Texas's efforts all that seriously insofar as they really believe that these guys are going to make that much of a difference. And I think that you know, there's some reason for them to be skeptical. On the one hand, that's so just because I think they've gotten off Battleground has to something of a slow start, and that there are all these challenges that I alluded to before, getting, you know, the so-called emerging demographic of Latino voters to actually show up at the polls, getting so-called Democratic rising stars to actually run, that Battleground Texas really may not be able to do much about. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have to take these guys, you know, pretty seriously. I mean, after all, you know, talk to the McCain campaign, talk especially to the Romney campaign. You know, these guys learned the hard way that the Obama field organizers really know their stuff, and so that they have a presence here and intend to stay here, if all of that is true, is something that they'd better take seriously.
Can you describe their sort of techno grassroots MO?
Yeah, well, it's difficult to describe because it's actually very retro in a way. I mean, it's, you know, while the Obama campaign has been thought of for its digital wizardry, the truth is that its field organizing is really about voter contact, which means mainly deputizing a local guy, let's say, to talk to his neighbors, sometimes to talk to them face-to-face, sometimes to do it via Facebook. But it actually requires this very, very labor-intensive, very sort of, you know, locavore, if you will, you know, this local movement not brochures, not direct mail, not TV ads, but actually, you know, local folks talking to the people who are likeliest to trust them and to engage in dialogue, sustained dialogue with them. And so that's what they've been training. They've been training volunteers to do that. And it's something that, you know, I think the Hillary, you know, Clinton organization, you know, sort of poo-pooed, didn't think that it really was going to make that much of a difference in, say, Iowa, and learned the hard way that it would. And so I guess the secret is that there's no secret, you know, to it, that it's very, very old-fashioned, but that it's a matter of a sustained effort and of real determination. And that's what the Obamaites have done pretty well.
Let's jump back on the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Jim in Cleburne. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
My question has to do with Wendy Davis' prospects for 2014. Is running for state senate or for governor, are they the only alternatives? 2014 doesn't promise to be a very good year for the Democrats, and I was wondering if she doesn't run for the Senate, one possibility would be attorney general. It's seen as a stepping stone to the governorship with Abbott or Cornyn was the senator, U.S. senator was an attorney general, and since there's no high-profile opposition from the Republicans right now, would this be a good alternative for her to pursue?
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Robert?
Jim, I think that in theory, you've nailed it. You know, you're absolutely right that the attorney general has been, you know, something of a stepping stone in the past. Certainly, Greg Abbott hopes that it will be again. In this case, however, Davis has announced as of a couple weeks ago that she's categorically ruled out running for anything other than the seat that she presently occupies or the governorship. So it's whether we can have a healthy argument about whether she'd stand a better chance running for the AG office or for lieutenant governor, but it would be a moot one because she said that it's going to be one of those two paths.
Is there some advantage to her politically of being at this point a little bit cagey about what she ultimately plans to do, given that so many people expect her to run for governor?
Well, I'm not sure that it's a matter of caginess, Chris. I do think that for a while, There was actual data to be accumulated on the subject of whether or not Texas would be, you know, whether she has sufficient name ID, whether she is wedded fatally to, you know, the abortion issue, whether voters are actually willing to consider a change beyond, you know, or rather than just pulling the lever Republican. So there's that, and I can't, by the way, state categorically that she has done all of that research. I have some sense of it, but it's kind of a sketchy sense.
Sure.
Now, though, I think that she faces a different issue, and that issue is timing. You know, that's whether it makes sense during the dog days of August to be making the announcement, whether instead this is better held off until, say, just after Labor Day. And, you know, there was this news leak, you know, about 72 hours ago to the effect that, oh, she's definitely going to run. And it turned out that seems to have had no substance to it. Davis's people certainly pushed back against it pretty hard, and it said it's going to be, another couple of weeks, which gets us roughly around to Labor Day, which means to me that she's certainly not going to announce right before Labor Day. She'll announce probably right after.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Tom in Dallas. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good. Appreciate you being kind of taking my call. I wanted to really kind of challenge Mr. Draper, who I appreciate what he says, and I will honestly tell you I'm a volunteer with Battleground Texas, and We're working very hard to do some things. But I want to challenge what I think was his attempt at equivalency. And he used one example, and I'm going to further this, and I'll take his comments, that the president demagogued an issue which McCain on immigration was somewhat supportive of. But that is the same time that he is supported by a party who has a platform that was steadfastly opposed to the direction McCain wanted to go into, who had a running mate who then and is now is a vehement anti-immigration person. So to simply say that, well, he demagogued the issue against McCain, I don't know if that's correct. And I don't know of any Democrat that he could state in this country who has gone as quickly, I say, as Greg Abbott did to set up standards of voting or voting practices or voting IDs that would disenfranchise clearly certain groups of people that aren't part of our party, or that you will find any Democrats that have stood up anywhere to do what the Republicans have done state by state regarding the rights of women to make certain choices with their own bodies and their own medical care. And I think this attempted equivalency really falls short.
Well, let's get a response for you.
Sure. I'm not trying to make an equivalency. You know, that's and you're absolutely right with Greg Abbott's remarks, which I think are going to they're going to prove problematic for him come election time. No doubt that whoever does run against him, be it Wendy Davis or someone else, is going to be echoing that time and again. However, I'm not going to step back from my view that the Obama campaign demagogued effectively McCain vis-a-vis Latinos. I mean, McCain paid, you know, a significant political price for being out there and the comprehensive immigration reform effort in 2006 and 2007. And in fact, part of the reason that bill was jettisoned was because a young senator by the name of Barack Obama helped pull his support for it on the grounds that there was a particular union-friendly passage that he was trying to promulgate. It was basically a poison pill for that bill. But even leaving aside Senator Obama's role in that piece of legislation, what they attempted to do in Colorado and New Mexico and elsewhere was to tie McCain to the way Republicans view illegal immigrants. It was very, very, you know, effective. There's no arguing about that. But it was demagoguery because it really was an inaccurate characterization of who McCain is and what he was fighting for.
I don't know about the specific depth of your knowledge of Tarrant County specifically, but we have an email here from Carol in Fort Worth who says, the county remains the only Republican stronghold among large urban areas in Texas. What do you think the secret would be to turning Tarrant County blue in 2014?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it happens to be true. But let's bear in mind that the person who managed to turn parts of it blue, at least, were Wendy Davis when she ran for District 10 in 2008 and 2012. Now, the way she did it was that she and her people were able to identify areas in Tarrant County that, in fact, were at least theoretically blue. These were largely minority strongholds, but they consisted of mainly African Americans, but also Latinos who just simply hadn't voted. And in those particular precincts, she captured upwards of like 90% of the vote. I mean, it's the kind of thing Brian Epstein, who worked for her Republican opponent, later made it sound as if this was like a Duval County situation where, you know, they had stuffed the ballot box. There's certainly no evidence of that. There's evidence instead that Davis really really, really worked those areas. So once again, it kind of goes back to the thinking of what is Texas? You know, the Texas that we imagine in that area, say, of being a swath of conservatism is somewhat belied by the reality that there are plenty of people there who, in fact, in all likelihood, would be Democratic voters. The trick is getting them to vote, and Davis was able to do so.
Given your interviews with the folks at Battleground Texas, Robert, what is their sense of the greatest possible mistakes they could make in these ongoing efforts, things that they could do that would be hard to undo if they didn't go their way?
Well, I think that, you know, again, for Battleground Texas, the biggest mistake that they most of their mistakes would be mistakes of omission, you know, not being able to get enough people registered, not being able to they have this sort of, as they describe it to me, field of dreams theory regarding candidates, which is that if they build all this infrastructure, then the candidates will come. That may not actually eventuate, you know, and it may require them being more forward thinking. They also, you know, another sin of omission that they may well commit is, and it's something that they've been talking about, and it may be that a parallel organization to Battleground Texas will take a stab at this. But someone, you know, for Democrats to win, it's not just going to be about them registering voters and casting themselves in a positive manner. They're going to have to do, you know, a more of a more, you know, blanket opposition advertising against the Republicans, more branding the Republicans in an unfavorable light the way the Republicans have done so successfully against the Democrats. And that's going to require, again, a lot of money, a lot of TV ads. And you know, this is a huge state with all sorts of media markets. And covering that waterfront is going to be very, very expensive for them. I think that the sin of commission that they could commit is by imagining that Texas is, as they have, you know, they've talked to me about the object lessons of Virginia and of Colorado and New Mexico. Those are the three states where they really managed to turn blue by dint of their hard work. But I think that the composition of Texas is far more complicated, and it's a more conservative state than those. For them to fail to recognize that, and I'm not saying that they do, but for them to paint Texas with the same brush that they've painted those other three states could prove fatal.
Talk about this. What sort of difference would there be in terms of the attention paid to Texas at the national level if this were truly a competitive state for both for Senate and also for the U.S. presidency?
It would change everything. I mean, there would be so much. And by the way, it would be like end of, you know, normal life as we Texans know it. I mean, now you guys would be getting – I live in Washington, D.C. now, and y'all would be getting, you know, when I get – because I'm in the Virginia media market and I'm bombarded, you know, during campaign season by – I can't like see a normal, you know, dog food commercial or something. You know, welcome to my world is what I'll say if Texas becomes a competitive state. So it's what it means, you know, is that – the state will be flooded with money from both national parties. It already is to some degree, but nothing like it will be if it's truly a competitive state. And it'll be interesting because, you know, Texas will then see you know, presidential campaigners. I mean, if this is a primary, you know, or a state where there'll be a hard fought general election, but also hard fought primaries, then, you know, Texas will begin to see in a manner of, you know, New Hampshire. Tons and tons of candidates who are going to be spending quality time. And so to that extent, Texas will be able to join the rest of America in being a competitive state.
Do we get better political service? I get that we get more ads, but would either party sort of work harder to give us what we want and need?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think if there's once again, if you're a U.S. senator and you're a Republican and you're not giving, you know, Texans what they want, your chances of paying a consequence for that at the polls are much greater if your only competition is not just in the primary, but also on the general level. So sure, that kind of accountability could actually breed more responsibility.
Robert Draper is a contributing editor to Texas Monthly and a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine. His August Texas Monthly article is called The Life and Death and Life of the Party. He joined us today from the studios of KUT in Austin. Robert, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
It was my pleasure, totally, Chris. Thanks so much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.